This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with the show's producer, Carrie Jr. II.
How you doing, Stephen?
Hey, Carrie. Today we're talking about something that I think most people just never spend time thinking about, and that is the world of victims' compensation. This idea that if you are the victim of a crime, if you have medical bills, if you miss work, if you have any costs at all, you are technically entitled to be compensated for that beyond what your insurance would cover. And Jeremy Levine is a professor of sociology at the University of Michigan. He's done a lot of research on how this works and found a really profound inequality at the core of it.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, to see how he's looked at states across the country that have these laws in place, the origins of where this law comes from. It's kind of an interesting cyclical process that we'll get into that's baked into the way this law works was insightful.
And one of the things I really like about the idea of talking to Jeremy is he's someone who came across this issue because he was a victim of a crime. So it's a great example of how something that happens in our lives leads us to a professional inquiry and a discovery that is a really important thing to add to the discussion about equality in our culture. So I'm really looking forward to hearing his story, hearing how he came to make this a professional pursuit, but then to hear how profound his findings were and just how uneven the idea of this compensation is. So let's get to it with Jeremy Levine of the University of Michigan. Jeremy Levine, it's great to have you here on Created Equal.
Great, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So I have to say, and I think this is maybe reflected a lot among our listenership as well, victim compensation is not something I spend a lot of time thinking about. So I want to start with you telling our listeners how you came to start thinking about victim compensation and the way that racial inequality has an effect on that part of the criminal justice system.
Yeah, so I also didn't think a lot about victim
this
compensation.
This is not your work either,
either,
right?
No. About 10 years ago, in 2014, I was a graduate student getting my PhD in sociology, and I was studying race and inequality, but in the context of urban development in Boston. This wasn't my area really at all, anything crime, victims, or anything like that. But as it turned out, sociologists every year, we have a big conference. And in 2014, our big annual conference was in San Francisco. And I was there to present some of my work and also enjoy the city, see a little bit of the city. So during that conference, it was on a Sunday morning. I went out with my wife, who was there with me for the conference, to again see the city. And we went out to brunch about 10:15 in the morning. We walked from our hotel. We were staying downtown in San Francisco, which is right adjacent to the Tenderloin neighborhood. So we walked to this kind of bougie brunch spot in the Tenderloin. And we were maybe about a block away from that brunch spot when, out of the corner of my eye, the sort of outsides of my ear, I hear some sort of commotion. And very quickly after that commotion, two loud, unmistakable pops. And again, I didn't really think, really know what was happening. It all happened really so fast. But I had a feeling, the way that I describe it, it was kind of like when you stub your toe. And you get that little like buzzing feeling on your toe, that kind of numbness right before you think something else is going to happen. You know something's wrong, but it hasn't quite registered in your brain what exactly went wrong. And the next 20 or 30 seconds or so, I black out. I have no recollection of what happens then. Yeah. I later learned from my wife what happened is those were gunshots. I pushed her out of the way to the left. We took off behind us, ran around the corner from where we were standing. And then at that point is when I come to. And so I look down at my leg, that place where I felt that stubbing toe, the upper part of my thigh. and there's a hole in my pants, and there is a sort of dark, wet spot, unmistakably blood. I put two and two together, and I realize I've been shot in the top part of my leg.
I mean, just that moment and that realization is something that, of course, most people don't experience.
Right.
Talk about that moment when you realize I've been shot.
Three things went through my mind. Two that were productive and helpful, and one that was sort of a little silly in retrospect. So the first two things that went through my mind were, one, get pressure on the wound. Two, get as many people calling 911 as possible.
Wow. That's pretty level-headed for that situation. I'm not sure that would be my reaction.
As I understand it, this is a pretty common trauma response, right? It's a fight or flight, and I went in straight up tunnel vision, get stuff done, yeah, and get moving. I had also recently seen a report about, in fact, in Detroit, about 911 calls taking a long time to respond to.
Yeah.
So that immediately comes from the back of my mind to the front of my mind. And I'm getting as many people as I see on the street to call 911.
Everyone call so that
everyone
they really
call.
Know that something's going on.
Yeah. Somebody walking down the street with his mom, I think going maybe to the same brunch spot, takes the shirt off his back to help me put on the wound to sort of stop
wow.
the bleeding. And the third, I'd say more, you know, silly reaction was I didn't want to look like the people look in the movies where they're flailing and, you know, embarrassed. I didn't want to embarrass myself, which sounds so silly in retrospect. But
it had hurt.
You know, it was like the adrenaline was out of control. So I really didn't feel anything.
Didn't feel
and in fact, you know, it's the upper part of my leg, the fleshy part of the thigh.
Yeah.
So in the way that I described it is kind of like I played sports growing up, and it kind of reminded me of getting one of those really hard hits in football,
yeah,
that deep bruise that really sort of when you step down is when you really feel it, but just sort of at stasis, it doesn't really have,
yeah,
you know, sharp, crazy pain, and missed the bone,
yeah,
and missed any real arteries. I didn't know it at the time.
So in retrospect, it's a minor wound, but it's still a gunshot.
Yeah, as the nurses later told me, I'm the luckiest unlucky person.
Wow, wow. So this happens to you. How does that lead you to the world of victim compensation?
So I'm in the hospital, and when you're a GSW, as the doctors and gunshot wound victim, I have chain of evidence on me. My clothes, the bullet that was still in my leg, that's chain of evidence. So police were with me at every step of the way, and they'd come in to the room where I was staying and joke with me a little bit, tease me about the pink shirt I was wearing, the contrast between a bullet wound, the kind of coolness of that, as they put it,
and
the
pinkness shirt.
And then in the end of getting my statement and talking to me, they give me a little slip of paper that had, you know, the size of my palm, that had the case number on it and then a phone number on the back, mm-hmm, for something called a victim witness program.
Mm-hmm.
Turned out not to be really what I really needed. But they said, you know, any bills that you have that you don't cover, that aren't covered by your insurance, we'll cover it here from all the taxpayers of the city of San Francisco.
Oh, wow.
Neither of which turned out to be true.
Okay.
The information on the city of San Francisco taxpayers do not pay for it and did not pay for this victim compensation. And the actual number they gave me was for a program that was not actually victim compensation.
Wow.
It was a different program. And I had to sort of seek out the compensation program on my own, given the little information they did give me.
So let's stop there. Victim compensation is, again, something that I don't think most of us, mm-hmm, think about. A lot of people don't even know what that is or, mm-hmm, means. So explain what they were trying to communicate to you. What were they trying to tell you was supposed to happen?
That's right. In every state and territory in the country, if you are a victim of a crime and suffer bodily injury, although that has changed a little bit in some states, but in general, bodily injury, any state or every state, whatever state that crime happens, will pay for the expenses associated directly with that injury. So, for instance, medical bills. Mm-hmm. If you had to miss work, the wages of the your hours that you missed, relocation fees if you're a victim of stalking, sexual assault, things like that. If you need to relocate yourself from an abusive partner,
mm-hmm,
changing locks on your doors, crime scene cleanup, or for the families of victims who pass away, funeral costs and things like that.
So it's an attempt to make people whole
exactly
for
right.
this thing that wasn't supposed to happen to them, but could have caused damage to their lives.
Exactly right. And it's also a payment of last resort, which is really important as well. It is there after
your insurance,
after anything else. In some states, after GoFundMes have already been covered. Although that's a place of legislative change and action as well. But everything else accounted for, whatever is left over to make you whole again, this is ostensibly government coming in to help, you know, repair those harms.
Yeah. So back to your situation, this happens to you. The police give you the information that they say is going to help you cover these costs, but it didn't happen.
That's right.
Why?
So they gave me the wrong number. They gave me the wrong program. They gave me a program called Victim Witness Program, which is really more for victims who are going to then testify and work to punish those that caused the harm. But I needed compensation for my medical bills. Of course, at the time, I didn't really think I did. I thought, look, I was a 20-year-old white guy. I'm a Harvard PhD student. I'm not thinking.
You're not that, thinking about where's the money coming
bills
from.
Bills,
right?
Or whatever, right? Yeah. It's just not from a violent crime. And I'm thinking I probably have good insurance, right? I didn't think I'd have leftovers. Well, I did have pretty good insurance where the $35,000 to $40,000 for the actual shooting part in the hospital, that was covered. What wasn't covered was $1,200 from the fire department for responding to the 911 call.
Okay.
So they charged me for that and sent me a bill to my Cambridge apartment. And that is what got then the ball rolling of me to then Google, find this program, find the number, reach out to them, and sort of get the ball rolling on applying for it and getting that $1,200 bill taken care of as they said that they would.
Yeah. And you have a hard time getting that done. Even though this is supposed to work, it doesn't.
Yeah. And thankfully, most states have changed this where you can now apply online. But back in 2014, which is not that long ago, I had to fax my application in. I didn't have a fax machine.
Who has a fax machine?
Yeah.
And at that point, you couldn't even fax from your phone, which I think you can do now.
Exactly. Like, so it comes and looks like a fax on my phone. So I had to fax all of the documentation, all of the bills, all of the sort of police-related stuff. So I had to use the ancient fax machine in my Harvard sociology department where I was a PhD student. We had to dust that off and send it over there. But then it was slow to process. And I got more bills from the fire department because it wasn't paid. And they increasingly became kind of threatening. One, in fact, said, if you don't pay this, we're going to take you to collections. It could affect your credit. It could affect your ability to get a car, buy a house. I call up the fire department and say, hey, like, I applied for this victim compensation. They're going to cover it. They should have already been in contact with you. And the response was, so we haven't got anything. Can you come down to the station and bring us, you know, the application that you have? We need to see the hard copy to see it's been processed. And I said, I'm across the country.
Yeah.
I can't do that. Can you not handle this? Like, how are you guys not communicating with each other? So I'm sitting across the country trying to triangulate between the fire department, the victim compensation program, to get them to talk to each other so that my bill doesn't go to collections and I don't have this sort of sitting with me and hanging over my head.
Yeah. And eventually you figure it out and you get it all worked out.
I think. So I submit it and I stopped getting the bills.
Right.
I got a bill from a collections agency or a letter from them. And then I just stopped getting any communication. I never got a hey, we've paid this. You're all clear. We're good to go. Like, we're really sorry that happened to you. That was it. Nothing. As far as I know, it's been paid. I've bought a house since then.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it hasn't affected my credit, but not a whole lot of after the fact. Talk.
Yeah. And so you go from that point, this individual experience with this,
right,
to wondering about, well, what happens to other people who aren't Harvard PhD students, who don't have means.
That's right.
And maybe aren't sure how to assert their rights in this situation. And you find that it doesn't work the same for everybody.
It does not. Not at all. In fact, it really doesn't work the same way for everyone. So from that experience, that happened. I was shot 8 days after Michael Brown was killed. And the relevance of that timeline is because after...
In Missouri.
Exactly. In Ferguson, Missouri, Michael Brown was killed. It led to a lot of protests and led to a lot of thinking about how do we pay for public services. Ferguson, 30% of its city budget was paid for by criminal fines and fees.
Mm-hmm.
How are we paying for this? How are we criminalizing people to pay for city services? And also, who's a victim and who's seen as a quote-unquote criminal. In Michael Brown's case, he was a victim of police violence. But in the aftermath of that case, his past transgressions, his past thefts got brought up. And Michael Brown was not painted or seen as a victim, was seen instead as a quote-unquote criminal. So both those things made me think, in this victim compensation space, how are these processes of who's seen as a criminal versus a victim and who's paying for this? Mm-hmm. How does that play out in potentially racially unequal ways?
Yeah. And what you find is that it's a pretty profound inequality. And we're going to talk a little bit later about the details of that. But talk about the kind of broad strokes here.
Yeah.
When you are African American and find yourself in one of these situations, things go very differently.
Yeah. So with me, I'm in the hospital. Again, I'm wearing my pink shirt, like I said, and the police officers are joking with me. I tell them I'm a Harvard PhD student here for a conference. And we have a very like joking rapport. I mean, they're kind of looking, want to look at my wound and see how bad it is, right? So there's a friendliness to that. And I think that reveals something really important about the victim compensation process. I mean, one of the big key eligibility criteria is that to get compensated, one must be not only just a victim of a crime, but an innocent victim of a crime.
Yeah.
And who's determining your innocence?
Who makes that determination, right?
The police that are looking and checking out. So it requires the police that are investigating this to say, okay, a crime did occur. In my case, there was a shooting. That the victim is cooperating with us, that he or she is saying everything that they know about what happened. In my case, they clearly looked at me and said, he's telling us everything that's going on. And they also have to confirm that no misconduct happened, that the victim, I wasn't doing anything that indirectly or directly.
Part of the crime, basically.
I wasn't injured while committing a crime, which was the original intent 50 years ago when these laws were written, but also like that I didn't instigate a fight. I wasn't buying drugs, and then there was a drug deal gone bad. I wasn't, you know, a sex worker, and it was a sort of a sex work deal gone bad kind of thing. Those are all things that can result in denials, and those are all things that can disproportionately lead to Black and Brown folks, and Black men in particular, being denied compensation and not seen as truly innocent victims.
Yeah. It seems to me that this is one of those tentacles of systemic inequality, right? We have these systems in this country that are imbalanced, and they have been since the beginning. We've made some progress. We keep working at it.
There
are so many ways in which that infects people's lives. And what interests me about your story and your research is this is something that's pretty far removed from some of the other things we think about. And yet it has a profound effect on people's lives.
Yeah, you'd think that it's like victims, right? That's not the people that are criminalized or the sort of over-policed folks. But that process that we've been talking about and talking about increasingly over the last few years are really directly related to this, right? If we think about victim compensation, it is by and large funded by criminal fines and fees, not general fund, taxpayer dollars, not appropriations.
Right.
So all the processes
that... who are being prosecuted and found guilty, they are paying for this compensation.
Yes, exactly. So all the processes that result in people disproportionately paying more or being targeted to pay those kinds of fines and fees and surcharges, legal financial obligations, monetary sanctions, we call them, all of those are funding this program, so they're related here. And then we're limiting this program to innocent victims. And how do we determine innocence? Well, we have the police that are investigating the crimes determine innocence. So any process about racial inequality that's happening among policing is also then going to affect this as well. So we're getting those that may seem tangential, but when the way the victim comp is built, right, the way the system is built, where it's funded by fines and fees through the criminal legal system, it's then relying on the police to determine innocence by and large, right? We're bringing in any of those inequities outside and then firmly putting them into the way that this program works.
Yeah. It's almost like an inequity tax that's being exacted.
Yep.
Okay, we need to take a quick break. And we come back, we're going to continue this conversation about victim compensation with Jeremy Levine, an associate professor of organizational studies and sociology at the University of Michigan. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. We'll be right back. listening to Created Equal from 101.9 WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and thanks for joining us. Our guest today is Jeremy Levine. He's an associate professor of organizational studies and sociology at the University of Michigan. We are talking to him about the world of victim compensation, something you probably haven't given a lot of thought to, the idea of paying for the bills that people incur when they are victims of crimes. This is something that goes on in all 50 states. Jeremy found out through a personal experience, in fact, that it doesn't always work the way that it's advertised, and that, in fact, the inequalities that exist in other parts of our society, the racial inequalities, play out in this world of victim compensation as well. Jeremy, I want to start this part of the conversation talking about just the data here. How big of a problem this disparate access to these victim compensation funds is. How bad is it for African Americans?
So if we start with the big picture numbers, you have about 1.2 million violent crimes each year in the U.S., and about 240,000 victims are applying for compensation every year. So already you're getting some leakage there in how many people are actually getting to the point of making those applications. And among those 240,000 or so, 24% overall are denied. So what I did is to try to figure out, well, who's being denied? What kinds of crimes are being denied? How can we understand what's going on here? This is public data, but not necessarily publicly available to download for all of us data. So every state has to submit individual level information of how many denials they have, the demographics of those that have applied to their state, to the federal government to get a federal subsidy. So those data exist, but they're not exactly posted as Excel spreadsheets up on states' websites. So I spent a long time, maybe about a couple years, in fact, hounding every state in the country to get access to these individual level data of who's getting compensated and who isn't. And about 18 or so states ultimately responded to my FOIA requests or just asking nicely. And I was able to then crunch the numbers across
all
the states.
That's actually not bad. I mean, as a reporter who struggles with FOIA and has struggled with FOIA for 25 years, that's a pretty good return rate there.
You know, hey, I'm not mad at it.
It's not what it should be.
I'm not mad at it. Yeah, you know, it gave me about 750,000 records over a period of time to try to make sense of. So I put them all together, put them in some statistical software to get a sense of which social groups are the most likely to be denied, and most likely to be denied for certain reasons. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so overall, the story is pretty clear, with Black folks and Black men in particular being the least likely to be approved for compensation, as well as Indigenous men and women as well to a secondary degree. But it's pretty unequivocal what's going on there, that they're far less likely. And we're talking about tens of millions of dollars that should be going to families and victims if they were being compensated on par with white folks, with Asian folks, with Latino folks.
Yeah. In fact, the data was examined by the AP.
That's right.
And what they found was that African American applicants for victim compensation were almost three times as likely as applicants of other races to be denied, and for behavior-based reasons. And that gets to this determination that's being made by police officers about who is a victim and who is a, quote, contributor, I guess, to the misconduct.
That's right. And so, I mean, one thing to also be clear on is that this, what I did, also controlled for a lot of other things in a statistical model. So you might be feel pretty confident that it's not just that certain types of crimes are least likely to be compensated. That's all accounted for, certain places or whatever. What's happening, about half of the denials I found, half of all the denials from those states, were coming from police-related decisions that were percolating up to the state agencies that were making the final decision. And three of those police-related decisions are the police determining whether or not a crime happened, whether or not the victim was perceived by the police as being cooperative, and whether or not the police believe that the victim was up to some sort of misconduct, what is called contributory misconduct, in the lead up to the crime.
And when you're making that determination, obviously you're looking at, as police do, the facts, right? The evidence, the things that happened that you can prove, I guess, happen. But, and in some ways that sounds like, you know, a completely non-biased process, right?
Right.
Here's what happened. We're describing what happened. But it's that determination and it's the relationship, I guess, that exists between police and the communities they police.
That's right.
That ends up messing that up. It becomes noise in what should be a non-biased process.
That's right. I mean, if you think about cooperation, right? Cooperation is dependent on a relationship between the police and the communities that they're looking to cooperate. And mm-hmm. if there's a fractured relationship based on other sorts of inequities in the criminal legal system, based on maybe communities feeling not connected, respected, or protected by the law in any sort of way, then that can result in kind of fractured social relations that can be perceived as not cooperative. There's also assumptions that get made when we think about misconduct. When officers are investigating the scene, who they assume to be lying, who they assume to be telling the truth, or what they assume to be the circumstances of a particular altercation.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Two quick examples. One in Oklahoma was a young man that was shot and killed at a hotel party in Tulsa. And he had a gang tattoo on his body. The officers assumed that the altercation was, quote unquote, gang related. But there was no indication that actually there was any sort of longstanding beef. And even if there were, he wasn't applying for compensation. His mom was applying for compensation to pay for his funeral.
Wow.
And she was innocent in all of this by any definition that we might apply to the circumstances of what happened.
So based on the tattoo that he had,
right.
not on the circumstances or the evidence from the incident in which he was involved.
He didn't do anything. He didn't get into a fist fight. He didn't pull out a gun. He didn't brandish a weapon, right? Another example in Nebraska, a young man that had been convicted of marijuana, selling marijuana. 2 years later, he's robbed and killed. No marijuana is found on the scene. There's no indication that he was selling marijuana as part of when he was killed.
Mm-hmm.
But the police officer said that this must have been drug related and whatever money he was robbed of must have been proceeds from selling marijuana, because how else would he have gotten money, right? His job, who cares about his job? They didn't even think about this. They just sort of made the assumption that it's someone that has had past criminal activity, criminal behavior, been convicted of a crime, that must be what's relating. And that sort of carries with them.
Mm-hmm.
That assumption gets placed on them. And then even regardless of the precise circumstance of what happened, they just make assumptions. Officers and detectives can and are able to make assumptions. And that can then result at scale, if those
right.
assumptions are systemic, at scale of having disproportionate denials for this misconduct criteria.
So I want to ask two really specific questions about
yeah.
that part of the process. The first is about this idea of innocence
right.
that we That's work
right.
with and has such power,
mm,
I think,
mm-hmm.
in our society, who is considered innocent and who
mm-hmm.
can, it seems like, maybe never be considered innocent. And then the second, of course, is this kind of low legal standard, I guess,
right.
by which police get to determine
right.
what happened in these instances and deny people compensation that they might be due. But let's start with
yeah.
that first.
Yeah.
The first idea, this idea of innocence
yeah.
is at the heart, I think, of a lot of the inequality we see in the
That's
criminal
right.
justice system. It is a fantastical idea
mm-hmm.
in many people's minds, but for police, I think it's
yeah.
one of the things that is difficult to manage in a way that doesn't represent
yeah.
that bias.
And it's not new either, right? W.E.B. Du Bois has this great passage in Black Reconstruction
mm-hmm.
where he says that if a black man assaults a white man, the police are on hand to get the person that committed the crime. If a white man assaults a black man, the police are more apt to arrest the victim than they are the person that committed the crime. And this sort of hits at this idea of, yeah, who is innocent and who also then is a victim, right? And those two things are kind of, are you know, correlated and on, you know, the same plane. And I think this relates to a concept in criminology, what is called the quote-unquote victim-offender overlap,
mm-hmm.
right? Because
mm-hmm.
we're talking about communities that are both have higher rates of crime and violence, which means they're also going to have higher rates of victimization, too. Right. And it's hard at times to sort of keep both those thoughts in our heads at the same time, right? That the people that the groups that may be disproportionately committing crimes because of for a whole host of reasons may also be the groups at the group level, they're disproportionately being victimized. But yes. It's hard to keep both thoughts in our heads at the same time. And it's hard for institutions as well. And the police being one where sort of being able to see that person and see them and look at them and say, that might be a victim, that might be an innocent victim, while also keeping those other thoughts that are in their heads at the same time. It's hard to keep that duality, right, in your mind at the same time.
Yeah. There's also a question about redemption, I think, right. at the core of this, right? So the two examples you give are people who may have been involved in crime in the past. Maybe they were even convicted. But the assumption that they have to still categorized that way and reacted to that way is a powerful part of the inequality that exists.
Totally. Diva Pager called this the mark of a criminal record. And I think the idea there is that having that contact with the criminal legal system, whether it be a conviction, whether it be at the group level, that sort of groups are targeted more by punitive criminal justice policy, marks people, even if they themselves may not, or even if they have, or even if the circumstances are unrelated to their past, you know, issues that they may have had or things that they may have done. And I think like this system is not built well. Mm-hmm. It's not built well to distinguish, right? It's built well to carry that mark with someone.
Yeah.
It's not built well to sort of take the situation for what it was and see that, you know, people can be complicated and have things that have happened to them before, things that they've done, but that's not related to the circumstances that they were victimized and to see them as innocent in those circumstances.
Yeah. And that becomes a community characterization.
Exactly right.
Right? These quote unquote bad neighborhoods where there are gangs, where there is crime. Everybody who lives in those areas is tarnished in some ways by these characterizations. And it would make it harder, I think, for them to get what's coming to them, even when they are, by definition, innocent.
That's right. And like in my case, a very possible scenario could have been that I was walking from my hotel through the Tenderloin, a not great neighborhood, like in quotes, I use scare quotes there, not great neighborhood, a neighborhood where there's a lot of unhoused folks, right? They're struggling with addiction, struggling with housing and stuff like that. It is conceivable that the police officers could have thought, like, what is this guy walking through this neighborhood? Maybe he was looking for drugs.
Right.
Maybe he was looking for drugs. Maybe he was looking to score. And that can be used and has been used against other folks. But they looked at me and they saw me, again, my pink shirt, there for a conference, 10:15 in the morning. I never felt once that they were in any way doubting me. But it's not hard at all for us to think about other situations, just like the ones I mentioned, where the police did doubt.
Right.
They did doubt the stories that were coming, that you come from that neighborhood, right? The incident happened in that neighborhood. That's a place where there's quote unquote known drug dealing that happens. Clearly that's what you were doing. Why else would you have been there?
Yeah.
And it becomes a victim blaming, implicit victim blaming.
Yeah. Yeah. And so my second specific question here is about the standard of proof to decide who's innocent and who's not. I mean, we're leaving this to police officers, and look, I have a lot of problems with the policing that we see in America, of course, and especially in African American and other neighborhoods with people of color, but they're doing a tough job, and they've got to make a lot of quick decisions under a lot of stress. But it seems here that the standard of proof is off somehow, right? They just get to say, well, this person is innocent, this person is not. You couldn't do that in court.
That's right. And they may not even know that that's the implications of what they're doing when they're writing the reports up. Right? When they write that an altercation happened and these were the aggressors, and then one of those quote-unquote aggressors, according to the police, they're an innocent victim, or at least think of themselves as such and apply to compensation. And then the compensation board looks at this police report. It says, no, the victim that applied here is actually the aggressor. So, you know, whatever, denied. The police may not realize the implications of what they're doing is number one. And number two, it's also not unreasonable to think that we should rely. Who else would we rely to do all this, right? And in fact, early on, when New York, which was the second state to pass the compensation law, they had an investigation team that would go out, go to the victim, interview them in their homes, mm-hmm. and talk about what happened. And a separate, state official would handle that. That was very expensive. And these are already pretty expensive programs. And to even get them passed required a lot of cost-cutting measures. And so that was thrown out. This was an easier way to get at that. But there's a third point here that I think is really important, which is stepping back and asking ourselves, how much does it really matter? How much do we need to know if a victim engaged in misconduct, someone that, again, applies to the state to say, I was an innocent victim of crime and I have medical bills. I'm not asking for a payout. I'm not asking for some money, some cash. I'm asking reimbursement for my therapist, reimbursement for the hospital where you can see what the wound was or what the sort of injury was. And how much are we? How much does it matter that they're cooperative with the police? And some states are making efforts that I think are really interesting and worth thinking about to not care about that, to rethink how much that really matters and how much we should really care about that. And one great example of this is the misconduct criteria, the contributory misconduct for families of murdered victims. How much does it really matter, sort of morally, ethically, for if someone did engage in some sort of misconduct? Maybe someone started a fight.
If they're dead.
Right. They're dead. And they're not being compensated. Their families are, right? And their families are innocent in any sort of circumstance that happened. And their families are the ones that incurred costs. Yeah. Their families are paying for the funeral costs. And how much sense does it make to deny them compensation?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue talking with University of Michigan Professor Jeremy Levine about victims' compensation and the way that inequality plays out in that part of the criminal justice system. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you've joined us. We've got Jeremy Levine with us today. He's a professor, an associate professor of organizational studies and sociology at the University of Michigan. He's someone who has been looking at the historical development and contemporary consequences of crime victim policy in the United States, with a particular focus on racial and gender inequality. Today we're talking about victims' compensation, an obscure, really, part of the criminal justice system in the sense that I think most of us never really think much about it. Jeremy Levine has done some research that shows the way in which systemic inequality, racial inequality, and other parts of our society leaks into the determinations of victim compensation. Jeremy, I think the idea of the idea of victim compensation is again something most people don't think about, but we also then don't think about why it matters.
Right.
And look, it's not that any kind of inequality should be tolerable, but why should this form of inequality, the idea that it's so hard for African Americans to get to this part of the criminal justice system, why does that make a difference?
I mean, at a minimum, I agree that any time material inequality happens, any time dollars and cents are being denied to folks that otherwise should be getting them, I think that's a problem.
We should care about
that. We should care about that. I also think that the consequences of what that means for folks that are applying to this and not getting it, for folks that don't even hear about it, that aren't part of getting it, and what that means for how they themselves might see where they fit in the criminal legal system, in, you know, the social and political order of the United States, what it means to sort of be seen and be told by your government, you are not an innocent victim. You don't matter as much as others might. Mm-hmm. I think that has really sort of long-term potentially consequences that wrap up into the same conversation we've been having about folks that are over-policed and what that makes you feel like as being part of society. Do you really feel included as part of the polity, as getting full citizenship rights, right? But I also think there's a bigger story here about how these programs are financed, and I think that really matters too. I think a lot of the conversation of those that do find out about victim compensation, it's about who gets it and who doesn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
But how it's financed, I find exactly critically important.
Right.
And it's paid for with criminal fines and fees, which means a couple things. One is when we put together the inequities, it means that insofar as people of color are disproportionately paying criminal fines and fees, that means that they're disproportionately paying for a program that they're then disproportionately ruled ineligible for relative to other groups.
Yeah, it's cut out of.
So you're getting redistribution from one group to another, to not them, even when they are the victims themselves. The other thing that's really important here is that this is one of those cases where we have an institution that's dependent on criminal fines and fees in order to pay crime victims. Mm. So crime victim advocates, right, out there in the world that are looking for resources, advocating for resources for crime victims, have no reason, objective reason to, you know, get in the way of criminal justice reform, to say, you know, decarceration, criminal fines and fees reform, reducing fines for folks that are convicted of crimes, you know, those sorts of policies. There's no reason for them to object to those, except when they're dependent on the revenue.
Right.
They need more fines, more people paying fines to pay into these programs. Now, you might think that, okay, well, if crime goes down, there's fewer victims, right? It'll sort of stabilize. But here's the thing. The average dollar payout for a victim is a couple thousand dollars. But the average fine that's paid for by an individual into this is $50, $100, even $1,000. So it's not a one-to-one.
Right.
You need more people convicted of crime than are actually committing the crimes for the victims that are applying.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are other parts of the criminal justice system where we see this kind of circular almost logic about how we raise money to pay for things that we say we have to have.
That's right.
And that fuels the way that we police, because that money is often coming from the people we're policing.
That's right. And it also creates just unlikely allies for or against criminal justice reform. Right. In Washington, a couple years ago, there was a bill being debated that would reduce a lot of these fines and fees. So take away DNA testing fines and a variety of other fines and fees. But lobbyists for judges, lobbyists for district attorneys got in the way of that.
Hmm.
And not because they were against the fines, not because they thought the fines were just punishment, but because, as they testified, that it would reduce the fund to pay for victim compensation.
I see.
We must help our victims. If we're going to help our victims, we have to get this money from them. That is how it is linked. But what kind of goes unsaid here is that that was a choice. The fact that these are funded by criminal fines and fees was not the original intent of any of these laws.
Right.
It was a political compromise to get them passed.
What do you say to people who would say that, for instance, in many of these cases, you are dealing with ambiguity.
That's right.
That maybe there's a fight and two people are both injured in the fight. Who should get compensated is a hard thing to determine, right? What's the right way to think of that?
Yeah. I mean, when I step back and think about this, it's like we are then trying to determine who's worth more. We're making sort of these moral decisions about moral worth.
And that's back to that idea of innocence.
Precisely. And I think then we're by definition going to be putting in a lot of other things. A lot of subjective thinking are going to be by definition being put into that. And me personally, I err on the side of more people being compensated is better. If someone sneaks in that may have been, you know, the collective we might have said, well, really, I'm not so sure. I'm fine with that. Because if it means that someone that otherwise really should be getting it, that's getting caught up in police bias, that the police came there and they just sort of read it, not really quote unquote objective, whatever that might be. For them not to be compensated to me is worth is something that we should be addressing and thinking about. And if it means bringing in someone else that might be on the edges, I'm fine with that. I think that's a good use of our resources. It's what it means to be a collective. It's what it means to be, you know.
I mean, unfortunately, there are a lot of people who don't feel that way.
That's right.
I think, and who feel that the more rapt attention should be given to proper use of public funds. I mean, that's the most benign way I can state that, I guess.
That's right. It's worth noting that these aren't exactly public funds per se, right? These are funds that were created. Right. And in some instances, they were new fines created directly to pay for the programs. Yeah. And in some states, only that fine can pay for the program. No appropriations are even available. Yeah. And that kind of gets sort of distorted in the conversation. And I agree. I understand that all of this is about sort of efficiency and stuff like that. But we have to think about who we're really talking about. We're talking about people that went ahead, went through the effort of applying for compensation, that submitted documents, submitted bills to the state government, that believe that they themselves are innocent victims. Mm-hmm. So that sort of selection into even getting to the stage of applying, mm-hmm. we're not going out and finding folks and sort of throwing cash at them, right? We're sort of having them sort of elevate to the point of applying. And mm-hmm. I think that, to me, is a sign or a signal of good faith. And I think that we should be thinking about good faith and making folks whole. And the alternative, however, would be to spend more money on investigation, to spend more public resources on really determining and getting more narrow on this. And I don't think that serves any of us from an efficient government perspective either.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the beginning of our conversation, talking mm-hmm. about what happened to you mm-hmm. in San Francisco, being yep. shot during a crime that you weren't involved in.
That's right.
Just kind of a bystander.
Yep.
And having to struggle to get this victim's compensation. What would have happened if you hadn't been able to resolve that?
Yeah.
I ask that kind of on behalf of lots of people who, as I said before, who don't have any experience with this kind of part of the criminal justice mm-hmm. system, may not know what their rights are or how to assert them. If you had not been able to resolve this, could it still be affecting you today, 10 years later?
It still does affect me, actually, when it comes to mental health. Like my wife and I, who was with me, we have different sort of now triggers when we're going about our lives, mm-hmm. even in our Ann Arbor bubble that mm-hmm. we live now, mm-hmm. That make us feel uncomfortable, where I can start to feel that fight or flight, mm-hmm. Where I can feel a panic attack sort of slowly coming up. And that's with having being compensated. Right. Had I not, I would have had that plus a $2,500 bill, two different bills from my subsequent surgery to remove the bullet from my leg, plus the fire department that charged me for calling 911 and for their response. That's $2,500, of which my insurance had already covered $40,000.
Yeah.
So had I not had that, had I not had insurance, had I not had the insurance that I had, all that would have stuck with me. I would have been paying that off over as long as it would have taken. Or in some cases, I would have just carried that debt with me and tried to ignore it. And it could have popped up in any sort of circumstance that may have come. And I think for folks that aren't getting this, they're on the hook for that.
Yeah. And that's how we get to this cycle of poverty aspect here.
That's right.
That this is another thing that can keep people from moving up the economic ladder.
Precisely right.
Yeah.
Precisely
yeah.
right.
Okay, Jeremy Levine, first of all, I'm really sorry about what happened to you in San Francisco. It's a harrowing story, but I'm really glad that it's led you to this really interesting and incredible research, and I really appreciate you coming to talk to
Thanks
us
for
about
having me.
Created Equal.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Jeremy Levine really took us on a journey there through the world of victims' compensation, but through the world of the tangled webs of inequality that spin around these root inequalities in America.
Yeah, and for me, I think it's the fact that the system was set up to help victims, but we know now that disproportionately Black folks aren't getting the compensation, but they're also disproportionately funding the model itself.
Mm-hmm.
That was the biggest thing to me. It's like, wow, this really transfers finances, wealth outside of the community. And, you know, just a remarkable finding.
Yeah, it was a great conversation and the kind of thing that I think we want to do here, which is illuminate places where inequality or opportunity exists that people aren't always sitting around thinking about.
So. Your point about the idea of innocence was really good too, Stephen.
Yeah.
Well, that's it.
Okay.
Good episode.
Yeah, I don't know how we're supposed to end these.
Yeah, on to the next one.
Yeah, on to the next episode. Created Equal is produced by Kerry Jr. II and David Lines. Our sound editing is by Connor Anderson, and our music is by Sam Bobian. Our digital team is Jenny Sherman, Dave Kim, and Sophia Joswiak. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET Detroit's Public Radio.